Chapter 9. We ran another large photo on the front page. It was Wiley's shot of the bomb before the police dismantled it. The headline above it screamed, "Bomb Planted in Time's Office." My story began with Piston and his unlikely discovery. It included every detail I could substantiate and a few I could not. No comment from the chief of police. A few meaningless sentences from Sheriff Coley. It ended with a summary of the findings by the state crime lab and a prediction that, if detonated, the bomb would have caused massive damage to the buildings on the south side of the square. Wiley would not allow me to use a photo of his badly bruised face, though I pleaded desperately with him to do so. On the bottom half of the front page, I ran the headline, "Times Photographer Assaulted at Home." Again, my story spared no detail, though Wiley insisted he be allowed to edit it. In both stories, and with no effort at being subtle, I linked the crimes and implied rather strongly that little was being done by the authorities, especially Sheriff Coley, to prevent further intimidation. I never named the Pagets. I didn't have to. Everyone in the county knew they were bullying me and my newspaper. Spot had been too lazy for editorials. He had written only one during my stint as an employee. A congressman from Oregon had filed some nutty bill that would somehow affect the cutting of redwood trees. More cutting or maybe less, it really wasn't clear. This had upset Spot. For 2 weeks, he labored over an editorial and finally ran a 2,000-word tirade. It was obvious to anyone with a high school education that he wrote with a pen in one hand and a dictionary in the other. The first paragraph was filled with more six-syllable words than anyone had ever seen and was virtually unreadable. Spot was shocked when there was no response from the community. He expected a flood of sympathetic letters. Few of his readers could have survived the flood from Webster's. Finally, 3 weeks later, a hand-scrawled note was slid under the front door of the office. It read, "Dear Editor, I'm sorry you're so worked up over the redwoods, which we don't have in Mississippi. If Congress starts messing with pulpwood, would you please let us know?" It was unsigned, but Spot ran it anyway. He was relieved that someone out there was paying attention. Baggy told me later that the note was written by one of his drinking buddies in the courthouse. My editorial began, "A free and uninhibited press is crucial to sound democratic government." Without being windy or preachy, I went on for four paragraphs extolling the importance of an energetic and inquisitive newspaper, not only for the country, but for every small community as well. I vowed that the Times would not be frightened away from reporting local crimes, whether they were rapes and murders or corrupt acts by public officials. It was bold, gutsy, and downright brilliant. The townsfolk were on my side. It was, after all, the Times versus the Pagets and their sheriff. We were taking a mighty stand against bad people, and though they were dangerous, they were evidently not intimidating me. I kept telling myself to act brave, and I really had no choice. What was my paper supposed to do? Ignore the Castle Law murder? Take it easy on Danny Paget? My staff was elated with the editorial. Margaret said it made her proud to work for the Times. Wiley, still nursing his wounds, was now carrying a gun and looking for a fight. "Give 'em hell, rookie," he said. Only Baggy was skeptical. "You're gonna get yourself hurt," he said. And Miss Callie once again described me as courageous. Lunch the following Thursday lasted for only 2 hours and included Esau. I actually began taking notes about her family. More important, she had found only 3 errors in that week's edition. I was alone in my office early Friday afternoon when someone made a noisy entrance downstairs, then came clamoring up. He shoved my door open without so much as a hello and stuck both hands in his pants pockets. He looked vaguely familiar. We'd met somewhere around the square. "You got one of these, boy?" he growled, yanking his right hand out and momentarily freezing my heart and lungs. He slid a shiny pistol across my desk as if it were a set of keys. It spun wildly for a few seconds before resting directly before me, the barrel mercifully pointing toward the windows. He lunged across the desk, thrust out a massive hand, and said, "Hey, Rex Varner, a pleasure." I was too stunned to speak or move, but eventually honored him with an embarrassingly weak handshake. I was still watching the gun.
"It's a Smith & Wesson 38 six-shooter. Damn fine firearm. You carry one?"
I shook my head no. The name alone sent chills to my feet. Harry Rex kept a nasty black cigar tucked into the left side of his mouth. It gave the impression of having spent most of the day there, slowly disintegrating like a plug of chewing tobacco. No smoke, because it wasn't lit. He dropped his massive body into a leather chair as if he might stay for a couple of hours.
"You a crazy sumbitch, you know that?"
He didn't speak as much as he growled. Then I caught the name. He was a local lawyer, once described by Baggy as the meanest divorce attorney in the county. He had a large, fleshy face with short hair that shot in all directions like windblown straw. His ancient khaki suit was wrinkled and stained and said to the world that Harry Rex didn't give a damn about anything.